Welcome, everyone, to the new 1001 Sherlock Holmes Stories podcast. Here you'll find a collection of Sherlock Holmes adventures, as well as the best of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. Some from our archives at 1001 Classic Short Stories and 1001 Stories for the Road, and some newly produced, all here for your entertainment.
Ah, Mr. Holmes. I was hoping I'd find you here working in the library.
My dear Tebbit, I know you are a tutor and lecturer at this college, but you must understand I am an extremely busy man.
I realize that, but a very awkward and delicate incident has occurred here at Magdalen. By chance, you are here, and I must turn to you for help.
I'm sorry I cannot be disturbed. If there is any trouble, I should prefer it if you would call in the police.
The police? Oh, no. No, that would cause a terrible scandal at all costs. Magdalen must avoid a scandal. I beg of you, Mr. Holmes, help us. For the sake of the college, help us, please.
We present the stories of Sherlock Holmes. Tonight,
a hollow victory.
It was in the year 1892 that Sherlock Holmes and I spent some weeks at one of the great university towns. We were residing at the time in furnished lodgings close to a library, where Holmes was engaged upon researches into early English charters. It was whilst he was busy with his research that Frank Tebbit, one of the lecturers at Magdalen College, burst in upon him. A gaunt man of excitable character, he was even more agitated than usual.
I must explain, Mr. Holmes, that tomorrow is the first day of the examination for the Hamilton Scholarship. I am one of the examiners. Today, at about 3 o'clock, the proofs of the examination paper arrived from the printers. I read it carefully, as the text must be quite correct, a large part of it being passages in Greek to be translated. There must be no printer's errors, you see.
Quite so.
At 4:30 p.m., I left as I had an appointment to take tea in a friend's room. I left the proofs on my desk. I was away for little more than an hour. As you know, our college doors are double, the green baize one within and the heavy oak without. As I approached my outer door, I was amazed to find a key in the lock. But it was not my key. I knew I had not been so careless. My key was still in my pocket.
Nevertheless, there must have been a duplicate. Who carries it?
Oh, my servant, Jackson, who's been with me for 10 years. His honesty is above suspicion.
Have you questioned him?
Yes. I met him in the corridor and discovered that the key was indeed his. He had come to my room to ask if I wanted to take tea, and he had very carelessly left his key in the door when he had left a few minutes later. Of course, in ordinary circumstances, it would not have mattered.
And what are the examination papers on your desk?
Oh, the moment I looked at the table, I knew that someone had been in there. The proofs were in 3 long slips. I'd left them all together. Now I found one on the table, one on the side table near the window, and the third upon the floor.
Tell me, Tebbit, is the scholarship a valuable one?
Very. There is a lot to be gained by getting it, including money.
Jackson entered the room with you. What was his reaction to all of this?
He nearly collapsed. I had to seat him in a chair and give him brandy. He was so upset to realize he'd been the cause of such an outrage.
Did you examine the room?
Yes. While Jackson was recovering, I tried to be thorough. I found evidence of a broken pencil, the tip of some lead near the paper on the table.
Ah, excellent. Continue.
Then a definite cut, about 3 inches long, in the red leather surface of my new writing desk. Both Jackson and I assured it wasn't there before.
Ah.
Oh, that is not all. I found a small ball of clay with specks of sawdust on it. I am convinced that these are clues left by the man who entered my room.
Very interesting. Yes, well, of course, I see your dilemma. If the culprit is not found, then the examination will have to be postponed until fresh papers are prepared. That would call for an explanation and could create a scandal that would naturally reflect upon you, the college, and indeed the whole university.
That is it, exactly, Mr. Holmes. Please help me to settle this matter quietly and discreetly.
Very well, I will look into it.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
Now, before you go to your rooms, just a few questions.
Yes?
Have you had any visitors in your rooms since the papers arrived?
Only one, I think. Raoul Sabra, a foreign student. He lives in the block. He came to ask certain questions regarding the examination.
Is he one of the entrants, then?
Yes.
And the papers were on your table while he was present?
If I remember correctly, they were rolled up.
Well, nevertheless, he might have recognized them as printer's proofs.
Possible, though unlikely. No one knew they were there, not even Jackson.
Where is Jackson now?
I left him recovering in the chair in my room. I hurried straight to you.
Well, then it amounts to this. Either this student, Shabra, recognized the papers and is the guilty party, or whoever tampered with them came upon them by accident.
So it seems to me.
Yes, well, we'd better go over there. Would you care to come along, Watson?
I'd remained silent throughout this interview. I was useful to Holmes when there were medical matters that needed attention, but this was purely academic. However, not wanting to appear uninterested, I agreed to walk over to Maudlin with them. It was nearly dusk when we reached Tebbutt's rooms. He was on the ground floor, and above him, he explained, lived three students. Holmes stopped and, standing on tiptoe, peered in through Tebbutt's window.
Oh, no use considering this as a method of entry, Mr. Holmes. There's no opening in the window except that one pane high up.
Well, if there's nothing to be learned out here, we might as well go inside.
This way.
We entered the building, Tebbutt leading the way. Tebbutt let himself in with his own key and bade us welcome. Holmes set to work making a thorough investigation of the carpet.
Nothing here. The day's too dry for footmarks. Jackson has recovered, I see. Which chair did you leave him in?
There, by the window.
I see, near this small table. Yes, I imagine what happened is that the man entered through the door, took the papers to the window so that he could see you if you crossed the courtyard, so you could make a quick escape.
As a matter of fact, that would not have helped him. I returned by the side door.
That's interesting. Well, that's what he must have had in his mind anyway. Now, let's see the printer's three pages.
Here you are.
So there's no fingerprints that are visible anyway. So many people could have handled these. How long would it take to copy one of these, using every possible method of contraction?
Oh, allowing for careful study and taking pertinent notes, I should say a quarter of an hour.
Then placing it on the table, he studied the next paper. He was still doing this when you returned unexpectedly. Yes, he could not have seen you cross the courtyard, but something disturbed him. He had not time to replace the papers. This is the lead of the pencil.
Yes, I have not touched anything, I assure you.
Good. Yes, an unusual type of lead. Not often used in ordinary pencils. Valuable. This is a small black pellet. Yes, I need to study this through my lens. Yes, and here is the cut in the red leather top. Yes, it's quite a tear. Well, this gets more and more fascinating. Where does that door lead to?
To my bedroom.
Have you been in there since discovering all of this?
No, I came straight to you. Take a look, if you wish. Allow me.
Thank you. What a charming room. I don't wish to pry, but I presume this large wardrobe is where you keep most of your clothes. May I? Yes. Large and convenient. Now, there seems to be... Now, what have we here on the floor next to the shoe rack? It's a similar piece of clay, formed into a pyramid shape, identical to the one by your table. Now, isn't that extraordinary?
Yes, let me see that. Yes. Yes, you're right. What does it mean, Mr. Holmes?
I don't know. It seemed that your visitor had access to your bedroom as well as to the sitting room, Mr. Tebbutt.
That does not make sense. Surely anyone wanting to take notes from my papers would be familiar with the layout of these rooms. Whoever it was could not have fled into the bedroom by mistake.
But then he must have done so intentionally, in order to hide.
But do you mean that he might have been hiding in here when Jackson and I came back?
Very likely. In which case, you would only to close this door, and you have had him a prisoner. But first things first. It's necessary, I think, that I meet your servant, Jackson. Can that be arranged?
Excuse me, sir.
No, Jackson.
Just the man we wish to see.
I came back to see if there had been any new developments, sir.
No, but this is Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, who are investigating. Please answer any questions as clearly as you can.
Of course, sir.
I understand all this happened because you left your key in the outside door. How extraordinary that you should do so on this one important occasion.
It's something I can't explain. I missed the key and realized what I must have done. I had a tea tray in my hand at the time, you see. I couldn't believe my carelessness. I hurried back, but met Mr. Tebbit in the corridor. And when we entered together, I saw the worst had happened, and someone had been in the rooms. I tried to be helpful, but the shock was too much. I felt ill, near to fainting.
Where were you when you started to feel ill?
By the door.
Yet you collapsed in this chair by the window. Odd?
I don't think Jackson knew what he was doing. We were both shocked. It was minutes before either of us could think straight.
Hmm. Yes, well, that will be all for the moment, Jackson.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Tebbit. Ring if you need me again, won't you, sir? I'm most dreadfully sorry.
Hmm. I'd like the names of the three students you say live above these rooms. Who are they?
One of them is the foreign student I told you about, Roe Shabra. He is quiet, keeps himself to himself. His work is good, although I would say his Greek is his weakest subject. Then there is Forbes, a fine scholar and athlete. Well, perhaps too keen on sport, but a fine young man. His father was the notorious Sir Stafford Forbes, who ruined himself gambling. The son is poor, but should do well.
I see. And the third?
Harland McBride. Brilliant. One of the brightest intellects of the college. But wayward and unprincipled. I know what your next question will be. Which of the three do I suspect? Oh, I can't answer that.
I'm glad, because I wasn't going to ask you anyway. But I was about to suggest a quick stroll outside in the courtyard before it becomes too dark. Shall we go?
Holmes led us out of Tebbit's rooms and back to the courtyard. It was not quite dark. Three yellow squares of light shone above us. The three students were spending the night before the exams in their rooms. Shadows moved across the blinds of one room. Is Raoul Shabra pacing the floor? An occasional movement came from Forbes's quarters. From the third window, there was a bright light, but no sign of activity. Holmes suggested that we make some excuse and call on each in turn. Tebbit thought it could be arranged and led us up the ancient staircase. At Raoul Shabra's rooms, we were welcomed a trifle coldly.
Please to come in, Mr. Tebbit.
Sorry to interrupt, but these are friends of mine who are looking over the college. This is Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson.
How do you do?
How do you do?
I am pleased to meet any friends of my tutor.
Oh, thank you. I'm interested in the internal design of these buildings. They're very well appointed, are they not?
I find it very comfortable here. Please do look around.
Oh, I am pleased to see that you're not doing any last-minute studying, Shabra. That shows confidence.
I do not feel confident. I am greatly worried. I am very nervous. I am lost to know how to spend this last night before the examination.
Ah, you have an examination tomorrow. I'm so sorry. We did not know. Shall we move on, Tebbit? Good luck tomorrow.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
I noticed that Holmes' eyes have been darting about all over the room, especially at the large desk by the window. Raoul Shabra seemed a mystery. Courteous and well-dressed, he could have been thinking anything as he bowed us from his rooms. We went up another floor, and this time called upon Julian Forbes.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Watson.
How do you do?
Come in. Make yourselves at home. I'm afraid I have nothing to offer you in the way of a drink.
Oh, that's quite all right. We're just making a brief tour of the college. If we accepted everyone's hospitality, we'd be here all night. However, it is very pleasant to meet you. I understand you have an important examination tomorrow. May I wish you the very best of luck? Oh,
thank you. I hope I will do well. I've worked hard for it.
Oh, glad to see you're so relaxed, Julian. Get an early night and do well.
Oh, I shall try. Thank you for your good wishes. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Again, I was aware of the intense scrutiny Holmes had given the room and its occupant. We followed Tebbit up further stairs to the rooms of the third student. This time, our reception was far from cordial.
Who is it?
Your tutor, Tebbit.
Go away!
I beg your pardon. I have friends here who wish to meet you.
Well, I don't want to meet them. Tomorrow is the exam and I have swatting to do. I won't be disturbed by anyone. Is that clear? Go away!
I rather agree we're not wanted, Tibbet.
I really must apologize.
Not at all. He has the right to sport his oak on an occasion such as this. I only want to know one thing about Harlan McBride.
And what is that?
How tall is he?
I beg your pardon?
Is he under 6 feet? Is he taller than I am?
No, not at all. Much shorter. Well built, but shorter.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to know. And now, Mr. Tebbit, I wish you good night.
But, Mr. Holmes, surely you're not going to leave me in this abrupt fashion. I must have some definite action. I cannot allow the examination to proceed tomorrow if one of the papers has been tampered with.
You must leave it as it is. I shall drop round early tomorrow morning. I shall tell you my views then. Meanwhile, leave everything as it is, understand? Do not change a thing.
Holmes remained quiet as we made our way back to our lodgings. He said good night shortly after dinner and did no more work on his studies. At 8 a.m, he came to my room and was quite his old self again, quite changed from the preoccupied person of the night before.
Oh, good morning, Watson. Lovely morning. Come, it's time you went to see Mr. Tebbit. Can you do without breakfast?
Certainly.
Tebbit will be in a terrible state until we tell him something positive.
Have you anything positive to tell him?
Oh, yes, my dear Watson, I've solved the case.
But, how could you have done? What possible fresh evidence could you have got since last night?
This. It's not for nothing that I got up at 5:30 this morning. I put in 2 solid hours of work and covered over 5 miles, and I have something to show for it. There it is.
3 small pieces of black clay, almost identical. Holmes, yesterday, there were only 2.
Quite. Now, this one I discovered this morning, and the 3 of them have solved the whole mystery. Come, Watson, let's go and put Tebbit out of his misery, shall we?
The unfortunate tutor was certainly in a state of great agitation. In a few hours, the examinations would commence. He appealed to Holmes immediately.
Heavens, you come, Mr. Holmes. What am I to do? Shall the examination proceed?
Oh, yes, let it proceed by all means.
But the culprit...
He will not sit the examination.
How can you say that? Does it mean that you know who it is?
I think so. And if this matter is not to become public, then we must pass judgment upon this ourselves. And so, in this private court-martial, so to speak, we shall take up official positions. Watson, will you stand there?
Oh, very well.
There, and ring the bell, please.
But that will bring Jackson.
Exactly.
Very well.
I say, Holmes, can't you tell us a little more? I mean, what do we have to do?
Oh, just you stand there and glare, Watson. Fiddle with your moustache and frighten the life out of anyone who comes through that door. Ah, here is the first person. Come in, Jackson.
Do as Mr. Holmes requests, Jackson.
Yes, sir.
Now, Tebbit, would you leave us for a little while? Please go down and bring Mr. Forbes down to us.
But I don't understand. I mean... What?
Do as I say, please.
Very well, but I must confess that I do not understand this. It is lamentable.
Now, Jackson, would you please tell us the truth about yesterday's incident?
I have told you everything, sir.
You have nothing to add?
No, sir.
Then I will make a suggestion. When you came in here yesterday, and you appeared to be considerably shocked, you sat down upon that chair. The reason was to conceal something, was it not?
No, of course not.
I think you answered that a little too quickly. I wonder why. You know who was in this room yesterday, don't you, Jackson?
No, sir, no.
It is a pity you feel that you have to lie. Stay with us, but stand over there by the bedroom door and wait. Ah, yes, I think the time has come.
Oh, it is lucky that I found you. I think you must have been coming to see me.
Yes, I was. It's very important, you see, sir.
Come in. Close the door. Yes. Now, Mr. Forbes, we are alone here. We can be perfectly frank with each other. We want to know why an honorable man such as yourself ever stooped to become the cheat you were yesterday.
What? Jackson, how could you? It wasn't me, sir. Mr. Forbes, I never said a word.
Ah, but you have now. Forbes, your only chance lies in a frank confession.
I don't know where to begin. How can I tell anyone?
Then let me tell the story, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Now, Tebbit told me that no one, not even Jackson, knew the papers were in this room. It was extremely unlikely that Rao Shabra could tell what the papers even looked like when he came in here. After all, they were rolled up. The chances of someone coming in here by accident and finding them would be too remote. Obviously, someone saw into the room from outside.
I see.
Forbes had been training that afternoon. He had his running shoes with him. the traditional kind, spikes on the soles. When he passed the window, he saw that you had been working on the exam paper. As he passed the door on the way to his room, he noticed that the key was in the lock. The temptation was too much. He let himself in and saw the situation at a glance. He placed his running shoes on the table and placed something, gloves perhaps, on the chair whilst he hurriedly made notes. Correct, Forbes?
Yes.
Thinking you, Tebbit, would return across the courtyard, he stayed by the window to watch. But you didn't. You came by the side entrance and he was caught. There was no escape. He grabbed for his shoes and made a tear in the red leather. Darting across to the bedroom, he forgot his gloves on the chair. Some of the black clay from around the spikes of his running shoes dropped off. One piece was left here, another in the bedroom cupboard where he hid himself. That third piece I collected from the pitch where he trained yesterday. Correct so far, Forbes?
Yes, it's exact as you've explained.
Is that all you can say for yourself after such infamous conduct?
I'm sorry. And to prove it, I have here a letter which I wrote last night. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't live with what I'd done. In the letter, I say I'm withdrawing from the examination. I'm ashamed.
Well, I am relieved to know you have recovered your self-respect. Why the change of heart, Forbes?
Jackson. He persuaded me.
Well, Jackson, can you clear up the last point in this mystery for me? What was your interest in all of this?
It's simple enough, Mr. Holmes. I was at one time butler to Sir Stafford Forbes, this young man's father. When he was ruined, I came here to work for Mr. Tebbit. I never forgot my old employer and made it my job to watch over his son. That's why I pretended to collapse when I sat in the chair in order to conceal the gloves. When Mr. Tebbit left to seek your help, I aided Mr. Forbes to escape. What else could I do? My loyalties. I didn't approve, of course, and I persuaded him to do the right thing. I'm sorry, but, well, can you blame me, Mr.
There was silence in those rooms at Magdalen College. Forbes looked down at the floor. Tebbit stared out of the window. And Jackson slowly left the room. Holmes said,
"Well, Watson, I think that clears up the matter. Breakfast awaits us. Goodbye, Forbes. You have fallen low. In the future, see how high you can rise."
Listen again next Sunday to The Stories of Sherlock Holmes with Graham Armitage as Holmes and Kerry Jordan as Dr. Watson.
Back. I wonder if I heard the footsteps on the stairs, if it might have been Eden.
Oh, Mrs. Hudson, do you mean that he isn't home yet?
No, not for 4 days and 4 nights he hasn't been here. Oh, Doctor, I'm that worried about him. What could have happened? Oh,
no, Mrs. Hudson, you know what Holmes is like. He's often disappeared for days at a time. Well, it's due to his work. It's customary. He'll turn up soon, so don't worry. Supper ready?
Yes, it's been ready since 8. But you know, this time I'm really worried about Mr. Holmes. I'm really worried about him. I'm worried sick and...
Yes, well, this time I'm worried too.
We present The Stories of Sherlock Holmes. Tonight,
The Rubber-Faced Man.
Sherlock Holmes' sudden disappearances. I knew he had many private hideaways in various parts of London, rooms in lodging houses where he could assume another name and identity. A master of disguise, he could mix with any class, from the lowest beggar to the highest in society. Always, of course, it was connected with his work. And regarding his current case, he was very secretive. I told myself I should hear in due course and tried not to worry, but there was a nagging doubt in my mind that all was not as it should be. And so, later that night, when I heard a commotion upon the stairs, I naturally thought Holmes had returned, but...
I'm so sorry to burst in like this, Dr. Watson, but Amy Castle is here, and she says she must see.
Oh, yes, yes, of course.
I must apologize for calling like this, Doctor, but I am in very serious trouble.
No, that's all right, Amy, come in, and that'll be all, Mrs. Hudson, thank you.
Oh, yes, sir, all right.
Right, now, come and sit down by the fire. Now, tell me what's troubling you, Amy. That husband of yours again?
That's right, Doctor. It's the old business, the smoking. You've tried to get him to break the habit many times, but... Well, it's the opium. Hugo's been away for over 2 days now. Well, you know what it's like. He can't keep away from the stuff. Of course, I've been making the usual inquiries, and I have tracked him.
Well, where is he?
Well, he's in an opium den called the Green Pagoda in Upper Julius Street. You know the road that runs parallel to the river off Bell Lane. I want to go and get him out, but I daren't, not on my own. So I thought, well, if you came with me as his physician, you could get in there and talk some sense into him. Well, I'll come with you if you like.
Well, I don't think that would serve any useful purpose, Amy. It would only distress you. I'll order a hansom and get over there straight away. Now, you go home and wait. I'll find Hugo for you, so don't worry. Hugo Castle had always been a problem patient. Like thousands of others in London, he was a constant visitor to the opium dens that clustered around the dock area. The Green Pagoda was one of the more respectable of these houses of iniquity. Near the river, to the east of London Bridge, it had a single door opening off a narrow alley. I entered, and by the low flickering of the oil lamps set against the damp stone walls, made my way into a low, long room filled with thick, brown opium smoke. Wooden burrs like those in an ancient galley lined the walls. Faint sounds of Eastern music came from the gin shop beyond the bead curtains, but no one listened. Groups of huddled creatures bent over red circles of light where the burning poison waxed and waned in metal bowls. Most men lay silent. Some were groaning or whispering, mumbling their own distorted thoughts aloud. As I entered, a sallow Oriental slipped from the shadows to offer the customary pipe.
Evening, my sir. Comfortable bed, very good pipe, long sleep and good dreams. This way.
Thank you. No, I'm not here for that. I seek a friend. He's around here somewhere. Would you allow me to look and... yes. Yes, he is. Yes, I think that's him. Hugo! Hugo! Hugo Castle!
Dr. Watson, it is Watson, isn't it? Watson, my good fellow, what is it? What time is it?
It's nearly 11 at night.
11? I must go home. Go home, I've been here all evening.
You've been here some 2 days. Now, pull yourself together, man. It's Friday, October the 19th.
It can't be. I thought it was Wednesday. You're trying to frighten me, muddle my thoughts.
Well, they couldn't be more muddled than this foul stuff has made them. Right, now look, I have a cab waiting, so come along. Let me get you out.
I only had one pipe, just one or two at the most.
Right, well, come along. I'll pay for you, and you'll feel better in the fresh night air.
Oh, give me money. Money?
No, not for you, poor wretch that you are. I cannot help everyone. Shh, soft your button.
Holmes, hush, you'll spoil everything. Keep your voice down.
What in it?
Look, I'll explain on my way home. I'll pay for that poor castle creature and get him into a cab. Send him packing and wait for me on the corner. I shall be but 10 minutes. Hurry, Watson, hurry.
I did as Holmes requested. Hugo Castle made no protest as I bundled him into a cab and, paying the driver, gave Hugo's home address. I was confident that Amy Castle would take good care of him and, once he'd recovered, give him a sound talking to. I would call in the morning and do my best to make him break the pernicious habit. Meanwhile, I waited on the corner. Holmes arrived, still dressed in beggar's rags, and joined me in another hansom. As we clattered our way homeward, Holmes said with a chuckle,
"If you could have seen your face in the lamplight, Watson. Now, I suppose you think I've added opium smoking to the long list of my other vices. Well, I assure you that, like you, I was visiting the Green Pagoda in order to find someone. You found Hugo Castle. I, unfortunately, have not found the man I was after.
May I ask who you were looking for?
A man called Maynard Burley. He came to live in London several years ago. He led a checkered, colourful existence, having been an actor, a seaman, and a tobacco importer. He bought a house, married a local lass, and settled down in Islington. Oh, he was happy with his wife and a young son. Recently, he's had no set occupation, but has interests in several concerns of the city. He travels to town every morning by train, returning to Shoreditch Station by the 5:15 each night. Last Monday, Maynard Burley left the house earlier than usual. His wife, Sarah, remembers it very well.
I'm going now, Sarah.
Maynard, dear, it's long before your usual time.
Yes. There are several things I wish to do before reaching the office. I want to do some shopping. I'll bring home a set of soldiers for the boy.
Oh, Raymond will love that. He's been asking for those for weeks. Have a good day, dear.
And you. But don't work too hard in the house. I expect to be back at the usual time. Goodbye, dear.
Goodbye.
Now, shortly after her husband had left that morning, Sarah Burley received a telegram saying that a parcel of considerable value that she'd been expecting from her family in Australia had arrived at the offices of the Tower Shipping Company. So after lunch, she went to the city. She did some shopping and collected the parcel. Walking back to the station, she crossed Bell Lane and at the corner of Julia Street looked around hoping for a vacant cab. She waited and looked up at the opposite building. To her horror, she saw at a high barred window the face of her husband staring down at her. She couldn't believe her eyes.
Maynard! Maynard! What on earth, Maynard? In a place like that? Tell someone. Please help.
She tried to enter the building. She couldn't. Because, as you may have guessed, the room she wanted was above the Green Pagoda building that we've just left. Eventually, she appealed to the police, and a sergeant from Tower Hill Station accompanied her back to the building. She identified the room, and as they climbed the stairs...
I know I'm not mistaken, Sergeant. It was my husband, all right. I saw him quite clearly. He had his hands up to his face. He could have been pleading with me for help. He looked so ill, and he covered his face with his hands. He is in here. I know he is.
Well, this must be the room.
But it's empty. There's no one here. But that was the window. Those long, dirty curtains. He must have been standing here and looking down and... Wait. What's this? It's a box. It's a box of toy soldiers. Present he was going to buy for little Raymond. What is through there?
Let's see. Another room. Then a window that looks out over the parapet and onto the river. Wait, there's blood on the windowsill. Fresh blood.
No. Look, there in the corner, the chair. Those clothes. When I saw him at the window, he was wearing a shirt but no tie. But these are his clothes. The clothes he was wearing when he left this morning. I know they are.
Leave this to me, Mrs. Burley. I'm convinced there's something really wrong here. I'll go and question other folk who may be living on this floor. You stay here with the clothes. I'll quickly get you out of this place as soon as I can. No place for a lady of breeding. What have we here? What are you doing, sleeping on the stairs?
I ain't doing no harm. Just leave me be.
You've been here quite a while. Have you seen anyone come down this way, from the rooms above?
No one at all.
Wait a minute, I know you. Mike the peddler. Beg on the streets. Pretend to sell matches, but you're a beggar, aren't you? Work a beat from here to Threadneedle Street. Have you been upstairs?
No, I swear I haven't. I don't know nothing.
No? Come on, up you get.
What's this? Huh? Blood. Blood all over the cuffs of your shirt. Well, you've got a lot to answer for, Mike Beale. Come on, come along with me.
And only this evening I have learned from men in the Green Pagoda that Maynard Burley's overcoat has been found in the Thames. I'm afraid it's a case of murder. I feel I've failed, Watson. What am I to tell that poor woman?
It was late when we got back to Baker Street, and I went straight to bed. The lights remained on in Holmes' room, and I knew he was far from satisfied with the way things had worked out. Over breakfast the next morning, he seemed morose and disinclined to talk. We'd finished breakfast, and we're lighting our first pipes of the day when Mrs. Hudson bustled in.
I've come to clear away, but there's a lady waiting on the landing, and Mrs. Burley, she says it's urgent.
Well, then show her in, Mrs. Hudson, show her in. Leave the dishes, you can fetch them later.
Just as you say. It's through here, please, Mum.
I'm sorry to arrive so early, Mr. Holmes, but I had to speak to you.
That's quite all right, Mrs. Burley. Please do sit down. Some coffee? Oh, I don't think you know my friend and colleague, Dr. John Watson.
How do you do, Doctor? No, I won't have any coffee, thank you.
I suppose you've heard the news. They found your husband's overcoat in the river. The police have it now. You may be required to identify it. Strangely enough, the pockets were filled with odd coins. Loose change, mostly pennies. It looks very serious, I'm afraid.
You think that Maynard was attacked by that peddler named Mike, or some other thugs, and his body thrown into the Thames?
I'm afraid it is more than likely. But you appear unafraid.
Mr. Holmes, Maynard is alive. I know he is. You see, I've just received a letter from him.
You have? You brought it with you?
Yes, here it is.
Ah. Now, let us see. Now, the handwriting on the envelope is not the same as the note it contains.
No, but the note is in Maynard's handwriting.
Yes. My dearest Sarah, please not despair. I am alive and will make sure all ends well. There has been a grave mistake. It may take time to correct. Please have patience, my darling Maynard.
It's Maynard's handwriting. I'd know it anywhere.
It's written in pencil on the flyleaf torn from a book. The envelope. It seems that the person who wrote it wasn't sure of the address. The name has been blotted first and the address added later. It was posted in Gravesend by a man with dirty hands and the gum flap smeared by someone who chews tobacco. Yes, your husband gave the note for someone else to address and post. There's something else contained in this envelope, wasn't there? I can tell by the imprint of a circle of creases on the paper.
You're very observant, Mr. Holmes. Yes, there was a ring. A signet ring. I have it here. It's Maynard's.
Ah. Then we must accept the fact that this message is genuine. But if your husband is alive and well and able to write to you, why does he not return home?
I cannot answer that. He must have some unfinished business that he has to attend to.
Either that or he can't return. He's incapable of doing so. Now, let me refresh my memory. To start with, your husband did not at any time show signs of taking opium?
No, never. He hardly smoked tobacco and rarely drank spirits.
When you saw him at the upper window of the Green Pagoda, the window was open. He made some sort of gesture with his hands?
Yes, he gave a hoarse sort of cry and his hand flew up to his face. I'm sure he was signaling for help.
Although it could have been a cry of surprise, astonishment at seeing you.
It might have been, yes, but it was over so quickly. He disappeared immediately.
He is alive and yet his overcoat has been found in the river. The pockets filled with pennies and small coins. Strange. Very strange. Well, Mrs. Burley, will you consider leaving this note with me? Take the signet ring, of course. But leave the note and future investigations in my hands. I will communicate with you later in the day with, I hope, encouraging news.
Just as you say, Mr. Holmes. But now I know that Maynard is alive, all I want is that he should be found. Please find him, Mr. Holmes. Please find my husband.
I went about my day's tasks and for a few hours forgot the case of the missing man from the Green Pagoda. When I returned in the early evening, I found Holmes pacing the room impatiently. He was fully dressed with hat and Inverness cape, an empty pipe clenched between his teeth.
Watson, good, you're back. I've been waiting for you. Do you think you could forego supper until a little later? I've work to do and I'm not sure I wish to tackle it alone.
Yes, if you need my assistance, then you've only to ask, Holmes.
That I know, my dear fellow. Here. A small brandy to fortify you for the night's work.
Thank you. That'll be most welcome. I take it, then, that you've made some progress.
Indeed, yes, I think so. I have a hansom waiting at the corner cabby rank. I must now put to test a little experiment. I think I behave like a blind fool, Watson. I deserve to be kicked from here to Charing Cross. I think I have the key to the whole affair. How many times have I told you that when all possible solutions are met with failure, what is left over must provide the answer? Oh, I've been as blind as a mole. Well, it's better to learn wisdom late than never to learn it at all. Come, Watson, finish that drink and let's be on our way. Hurry, man, hurry.
Within minutes, we were in a cab and pounding our way across London. The horse buses were filled with folk on their way home. The shopkeepers were about to put up their shutters. The gas lamps glowed at every street corner. And Holmes muttered angrily at the slow progress we were making. I could tell from the direction we were taking that Holmes was playing the game by the correct rules. We were heading for Tower Bridge and the police station. Sergeant Bennett, who'd been with Mrs. Burley on the Monday's raid on the opium den, was on duty.
Evening, Mr. Holmes. Well, what can I do for you?
I've called about Mike Beale, the beggar who was questioned regarding the disappearance of Maynard Burley. Have you held him for questioning?
He's about to be remanded on a full charge. At the moment, we know he's still in his room above the Green Pagoda. The place has been closed down. It's under surveillance night and day. No one allowed in or out.
I see. So Mike the peddler is virtually a prisoner in that place?
Oh, put it that way if you wish. Of course, there's no way we could forcibly hold him. But he knows if he as much as puts his nose out from the street, we shall grab him on some charge or other. Can't let him slip through our fingers.
No, no, of course not.
If he left that place, he could vanish in a couple of minutes into the dock area on a ship and out of the country in 24 hours. That's why we've got him shut up in there, pending further evidence. Once we find the body of Maynard Burley, we'll slap a murder charge across Mike Beale quicker than lightning.
Well, you may be bending the law a little, Sergeant, but I'm very grateful for it. Yes, I suspected as much. That's why I'm here. You see, I want to ask Mike the peddler a few questions. I knew I should be unable to get in to see him without you. Can you arrange to have Watson and me let into that building?
Oh, I'll do better than that, Mr. Holmes. I'll come along with you. There, Constable. I'm off on the Burley case. Expect me when you go off duty.
Very good, sir.
Come on, Mr. Holmes. I'll have the station wagon get us there right away.
It was a short ride this time. Within a matter of minutes, we drew up outside the dark alley that led to the Green Pagoda. This time, all was still. There was just the music wafting in from the gin shop next door. But the opium den was deserted. It still smelt of smoke and filth. By the light of a lantern, the sergeant showed us the way through and up the stairs to the sleazy rooms above.
He's got to be in here. Can't have left. Mind you, I doubt if we'll be able to get much sense out of him. He just mutters into that filthy grey beard of his.
What was his explanation regarding the blood on his shirt cuffs?
Well, he said he'd fallen and cut his wrist on a bit of broken glass. The funny thing is, he did have a nasty cut. Didn't go into details. He couldn't. He was too drunk to talk much. Of course, he has had time to sober up, being in here all alone. That's unless he's got a real good supply hidden away. Right. This should be where we'll find him. Second door on the right. In here.
The sergeant held the lantern high above his head as he entered the room. It was empty, but for a trestle bed and a table in the far corner. On the bed, covered by a single blanket, was the man we wanted. He was asleep, his face towards us. An uglier man I've seldom seen. His face seemed bloated, yet crustaceous, and of an unreal pallor. I'm a medical man, and not easily shocked, but I was repelled by this sight. Holmes, on the other hand, seemed totally unaffected, but whispered to me urgently.
Don't wake him. Just move close enough to hold him fast. When I tell you, seize his arms. Use all your strength. He's going to put up a devil of a struggle. Wait. Right.
What now?
What the hell? Hold him up. Let me go. Now, let me get his face. Yes, I've got to show you his real face. Hold on. It's coming away.
No!
What the devil is
that? His whole face is coming away. It's peeling off like the bark of a tree.
Yes, and the gray hair, too. Off with that. Come on. Light the lamp on the table, Sergeant, and ask this man that question. All right, you may get up now, Mr. Maynard Burley.
What the devil is it?
All right. I give in. What am I charged with now?
You really are Mr. Maynard Burley.
If I am, then clearly I cannot be responsible for my own death. So legally, I must be allowed to leave.
You may not have committed a major crime, Burley, but you've caused a grave disruption of the public peace. You've disgraced yourself. And above all, you've let your wife down most dreadfully. If you feel anything for her and your son, then now is the time to make amends.
Well, it was something I drifted into. And once in, I couldn't see a way out. You see, in my youth, I'd been on the stage, and when things became difficult, I thought I'd turn to writing. I wrote a series of articles on what it was like to be a beggar of the streets. In order to find out by first-hand knowledge, I became a beggar. I used a rubber mask, a different whining voice, and I got all the information I needed. I wrote the articles, and they were a success. Then times changed. I found I could make more money as a beggar than I could as an honest journalist. I could make over £1 a day by whining and begging. I still had a little money from my investments, but regular employment seemed to evade me. I took to begging as Mike Beale, as a profession. I left our modest home in Islington each morning, well-dressed for the city. I begged all day and changed back into my city clothes in the late afternoon. I rented these rooms above the Green Pagoda for changing purposes. Imagine my horror when I looked out of the window last Monday and saw my wife in the street below. I rushed into the room, threw my overcoat with the day's takings into the river. As I did so, I cut my wrist on the broken window pane. There was blood everywhere. I donned my rubber mask and hurried to the room below, pretending a drunken sleep. I assumed the identity of Mike Beale. I've had to do it ever since. I've been waiting for the chance to slip away, go back to Sarah and my young son.
Yes, you were worried about them. That's why you arranged to send your wife that note and your signet ring, posted by one of the inmates of the Green Pagoda before it was closed down. As well, Mr. Burley, it seems to me that you have a great steel upon your conscience. You obviously cannot be held for the murder of Maynard Burley, but how you'll be able to face up to your wife again is something I shall never know.
Holmes looked at the sergeant, who appeared completely baffled. The sergeant shrugged his shoulders and indicated that he didn't know what line of action to take. It was Holmes who took the initiative.
If the police manage to hush this up, Burley, well, there must be an end to this. No more begging, no more Mike Beale.
I swear by the most solemn oath that it shall be so.
Then I think you should tell your wife everything. If she is the lady I think she is, then she will find it in her heart to forgive you. I promise you that we shall be silent. The rest is up to you. Well, now, Watson, how about that supper waiting for you back at Baker Street? Shall we get back to it straight away?
Listen again next Sunday to The Stories of Sherlock Holmes, with Graham Armitage as Holmes and Kerry Jordan as Dr. Watson.